This paid commercial may not represent the views of Hubbard Broadcasting Incorporated or Federal News Radio. Statements and opinions of this broadcast are solely those of individual contributors or advertisers as indicated. Federal News Radio does not take responsibility for those statements or opinions and accepts no responsibility or liability for any inaccuracy, errors, or omissions reported during this program.
Welcome to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. Off the Shelf gives a voice to commercial service and product companies selling in the federal market. Roger speaks to members and government officials about procurement policy trends, innovations, and debates. Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM. Now, your host, Roger Waldron.
Today, my guest on Off the Shelf is John Etherton of Etherton & Associates. John, welcome to the show.
Thanks, Roger. It's good to be back.
Well, John, you are known as a keen observer of the Hill and all things that go on there. And today I thought it would be a great opportunity to sort of look back and forward, I guess, so to speak, about the DOD authorization bill, sequestration, other topics. So without further ado, let's dive right into it. And, you know, first, I'd like, can you give us an overview of the procurement, particularly the procurement-related provisions of the DOD authorization bill?
Sure. First of all, let me give you sort of a process overview. If folks that have been following the process closely would know that the House has passed their bill, they got it out of committee, got it to the floor, dealt with the floor amendments, and basically got it off the floor before the Memorial Day recess. The Senate Armed Services Committee finished their markup of the bill in committee before the Memorial Day recess, but they've not yet been successful in getting their bill to the floor. So we're looking at a pretty compressed, late, lame duck session, not exactly sure how that will play out, what the issues will be, but we're kind of running out of time. And right now, as I understand it, the staffs have been having some informal conversations to at least understand what the issues are and to make sure that everybody's clear on what the views are and things like that. And my expectation is that when the members return on the 13th in November after the election, there'll be a real push to try to finish that bill among all the other things that they're doing. There's a possibility, in my mind, that the bill could even make it to the Senate floor in that week between when they come back on the November 13th and when they go away a week later for the Thanksgiving recess. So, but if not, I think there'll be other ways of looking at how to get that bill through, because the bill has a number of special pay authorities that have to be renewed on an annual basis, and right now that language is not included in the continuing resolution.
So the special pay authorities, is that for like the folks overseas,
right,
and things like that?
Right, okay. Right. Mm-hmm. A number of personnel things that are pretty critical, especially as we're in the middle of war right now. So they will have to pass some part of the bill either as a freestanding piece of legislation or as part of another piece of legislation, and the continuing resolution is already done, so that's not an available vehicle to do that. So they have a lot of incentive to try to work out that issue as well as the other issues associated with the bill. So that's where the process is right now. And I think if the Senate is successful in bringing the bill up, I think, and there is an attempt I also right now to get a unanimous consent agreement on the Senate floor so that they can limit amendments to germane issues associated with the bill rather than anything under the sun that a member may want to try to attach. If they're successful at some point in limiting the debate, it's quite feasible that they could finish it within a week's time and be off the floor by Thanksgiving. But if that doesn't happen, I think they'll look at some other ways of trying to pass the bill, either using the Senate reported version from the Senate Armed Services Committee or some other mechanism to bring the bill forward. So I think we're going to see a lot of activity. As most people know in the acquisition world, that is the vehicle where most of the acquisition policy provisions that affect not only the Department of Defense, but also the civilian agencies, really that's the vehicle that a lot of those things get moved every year. You don't see very many freestanding bills on this subject coming through or the bills being attached to other
things. Sure, yep. Uh-huh.
So there's a lot, the things that are in Title VIII of the bill and in some...
But let me ask you a question on that.
Go ahead.
Historically, why is that the case now that it's the DOD authorization that drives procurement policy?
I think that the fact is that the Armed Services Committee staffs and members are used to having an authorization bill through the process every year. And so they understand how to put the bill together, they understand how to work the process to actually get that result. Other committees that may have an interest in that aren't as, I guess, used to putting bills together and seeing them pass on that frequent of a basis. so that you know that if you can attach your language to that bill,
right,
then it's going to go through, or at least it will have a good shot at going through.
So and time and time again, you see, you know, separate bills introduced that are, you know, focusing purely on acquisition.
Right.
And then pieces of those end up in the defense authorization
right.
bill, and that's how they get passed
right.
along.
Right, and they get added as amendments. Or you may have a provision that starts out as a DOD only, a Title 10 provision, and then as time goes on, people say, well, if this is going to be good for the Department of Defense, it's good for the entire government, and it'll be expanded to be, include language in Title 41 as well. So it is sort of the vehicle that people are used to using to prosecute acquisition policy and acquisition reform in the Congress. And I don't think this year will be any different. And this year we have a number of issues in the bill that we can talk about a little bit. I think one of them that we're looking at right now is very interesting. It has to do with commercial acquisition. Back in the mid-1990s, one of the major acquisition reforms in the Federal Acquisition Streamlining Act was to open up the acquisition process to a much greater degree to commercial products and to eliminate some of the requirements that companies would have to follow in order to sell things to the federal government, especially for companies that were pure play commercial companies. And at the time we were involved in that legislation, we came up with a pretty broad definition of commercial item, and including mm-hmm. so-called items or services that were of a type that are sold in the marketplace, even though the company selling them to the federal government might not themselves sell that service in the broader commercial marketplace. But there is, at least there would be some setting of terms, condition, prices, or whatever by market forces in the commercial marketplace. And that whole approach has come under some fire by certain elements in the government as being not sufficiently protecting taxpayers' interest in terms of pricing and things like that. So this fall, or spring rather, the Department of Defense had actually proposed language which would take the definition of commercial item and limit it only to those items that are sold in substantial quantities to the general public, essentially.
Going back in time
going
to
back
the pre-FASA rule,
right.
essentially.
And so that anybody selling things that were not in that relatively narrow category to the federal government would basically, if that for that transaction, they would basically have to comply with the requirements, say, for certified cost or pricing data on pricing and things like that, which require certain types of tracking systems and cost. Yep. You know,
that commercial firms don't generally do.
That they don't generally do because there's absolutely no value added for them in their commercial sales to having those kinds of systems in place. They don't, you know, it's just additional overhead for them and additional costs and a disincentive to do business with the federal government. It's a very complex issue. The Senate Armed Services Committee rejected the proposal that the department put in place, but they did provide a provision, which is Section 841 in the bill, which essentially expands the ability of the department in certain categories of items that are associated with major weapons systems, which may be commercial items, to require a company to submit actual certified cost or pricing data for pricing purposes, which raises a lot of very interesting issues because I believe the committee members believe that this would be a relatively narrow opening. In fact, in terms of the research that some of us have done, it looks like it would be a fairly, potentially fairly broad authority that the department would have. And so we're sort of debating how do you deal with the process and
broad in
issue.
What sense?
Well,
it
could if you look at a large weapon system, say. And you
lots of commercial products. And
well, at the top
pieces, services
right, you
associated.
You would look at the prime contract, and you would say, "Well, I don't see anything in here that's necessarily commercial." But if you go down through the supply chain and through the various levels of subcontractors, the further down in that supply chain that you get, the more you see more and more commercial suppliers, especially for things like electronics, and things like that. So the question is, what impact does language like this have if you're exposing a supplier to the potential for having to have a system in place at some point to have to provide certified cost of pricing data? And that raises a lot of issues. A lot of folks are pretty nervous and anxious about it. And I think it raises this bigger issue, which is we had sort of a system in place from the 1990s which said if you want to do business with the federal government, it was a fairly clear path in different directions. We now seem to be shifting a little bit away from that model and saying that notwithstanding some of these things that we put in place, there is a potential for being exposed to having more of these compliance systems or more specific government requirements in order to sell to the government, even though that portion of your sales may be relatively small as a percentage. And so the question is,
so it becomes, with a private company, right, the question becomes, is it worth it?
Right, exactly. Right?
I mean, because, you know, you take any of these big companies you could name that people would recognize,
right.
The government likes to say, I've heard this many times, oh, we're the biggest buyer.
Right.
Well, first of all, you're not as big as the entire rest of the commercial marketplace, right? Where terms and conditions are developed and in commercial practices. And secondly, for most of these companies, you are a very, very small percentage of the overall business that company does, worldwide or whatever. And to drive business operations by somebody who may represent less than 1% or 2% of overall revenue, that's...
For example, you may have a product that you're manufacturing on your commercial line that is modified for government purpose.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And the question is, do you want to force a company to create a separate division or separate production line, or at least face them with that choice? You may deny yourself the technology. You may deny yourself the investments that a company might make outside of the government funding stream in technology development. And so this raises a lot of issues.
Yeah. Right now, John, we do have to take a break. But when we return, we'll be talking more to John Etherton of Etherton & Associates. And we'll talk some more about this commercial item issue and other provisions in the DoD Authorization Act for this year. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
In the ever-changing national security and IT environments, L3 delivers innovative, cost-effective solutions. As a Fortune 200 company, L3 offers customers global end-to-end services and solutions for large-scale systems. No matter the challenge, L3 has the agility, technology, and innovation required for mission performance. From cybersecurity to next-generation IT, L3's passion for its customers' missions drives its commitment to excellence. L3. Agility, innovation, performance.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we are talking to John Etherton of Etherton & Associates, and we're talking about the DoD authorization bill this year and what's in it and from a procurement perspective. And John, we were talking about commercial item and the potential change in requirements related to subcontracts and major weapon systems, and you had some additional thoughts there.
Well, I guess the point I was trying to make was we seem to be moving away from a set of sort of understandings that we had in the mid-90s, which we may do for good reasons or not. My thought is that we ought to be thinking about this a little more holistically, and rather than do a set of piecemeal changes or piecemeal proposals to address what people perceive as dealing with a set of small set of examples of things that they regard as abuses, that we ought to be looking at this more holistically and saying, if we don't want to have the old model of how you do business with the federal government, either as a commercial company or not, we ought to be looking at the requirements and the other kinds of things that we're willing to put on companies to say that if you deal with the federal government, we're going to have all these special requirements and what the impacts of that are going to be and how much of that we can afford. So I think this particular issue raises that. I think the language that we had in last year's bill on technical data rights, raised a lot of the same issues. And I think I see these issues continuing to arise as we go over the next
year. Is it just the swing of the pendulum to use the old cliche that we use? I mean, probably other worlds use it too, but in the procurement world, it's swing of the pendulum, or is it arising because there's been specific concerns that people have identified?
I think it's because of specific concerns. I think that if you talk to people, for example, on the pricing side, they can tell you about abuses that folks have claimed that something was a commercial item that was really developed 100% at government expense, for example, and that it was just a matter of a company maybe using the commercial item exemption as a shield from providing data that would allow the government to get a better price reasonableness determination or something like that. And I think there are those cases. I think the real question is, though, what if we make a change, how can you measure the what you lose if you make
yes.
a change on the other side? And I've heard a lot of compelling information about the amount of private sector investment in technologies, for example, that the department benefits from that the department doesn't have to pay for, other kinds of overhead that get carried by the overall customer base, including the commercial customers, that, again, the federal government doesn't have to pay for, and in some cases, the ease with which the government can get a new product through a more streamlined process and, again, into the hands of the users. And I think those are all real benefits that need to be taken into consideration when we look at some of these changes.
Well, also, I would submit, and I mean, you can agree with me or not, or you may not want to agree with me, but it seems to me just when I look at some of those things and some of the concerns that are raised, I raise the question whether or not it's not the rules, it's how people right. have executed or interpreted the rules and not actually manage to those rules,
right.
for lack of a better term, in that, you know, so you're trying to, you know, again, fix something because somebody didn't execute as well as they could by writing another rule.
Right.
A more restrictive rule.
Right.
I know government does that all the time, but...
Well, and I think it raises a couple of issues. Number one, do the existing rules provide for adequate mechanisms to address the whatever the evil is that you're trying to correct? That's one question, and I don't think in the case of commercial pricing, frankly, we've explored that enough. I think, for example, the authority under the Truth in Negotiation Act to get other than certified cost or pricing data is fairly broad. Does, at least the way I read it, cover, for example, uncertified cost data. It may not be in the format that you get with the certified cost or pricing data. And I mean, I understand that if you can say to somebody, give me certified cost or pricing data, in a sense that forces a company to adopt cost accounting standards compliant systems, which means that you will get it in a format that's very easily recognizable and doesn't require as much judgment. And so I understand.
Well, what
that.
You also might get there is like that company's, okay, I've got to create a, you know, a separate
right.
legal entity to deal with the government.
Right.
That increases cost to the government in the long run.
Right. And they may make a decision that I don't no longer want to supply either as a subcontractor or as a prime, so get somebody else to do it.
Right.
I mean, so that, you know, that's, those are some of the questions I think that you really need to ask. And are we making full use of the existing
sure.
authorities before we take these additional steps? None of the changes, in my experience, in this area have ever been free lunches. There's always something that you give up to get something
sure,
else.
Sure, absolutely. So what are some of the other provisions, procurement-related provisions?
There are a couple other ones that are interesting. We're looking at a lot of concern right now about the whole idea of the blended workforce and contractor personnel who are providing services either as separate entities providing services or working side-by-side with federal employees. And given some of the pay freezes and other things that we've seen put in place for federal employees, there seems to be a feeling, and it's really expressed more strongly in the Senate bill, that the contract employees ought to be treated, or the contracts ought to be treated in a similar fashion. Last year we had language in the bill, it's section 808 in the FY12 bill, which essentially capped the overall expenditure for services contracts in the Department of Defense at the FY10 levels, which, given the overall cuts in the budget, in my opinion, is probably not so problematic. But in addition to that, there are also some further layers of cuts on individual contracts where people say, well, that's for a similar service or whatever in a similar scope. And there's real strong guidance that the cost of that should not be any more than it was in FY10. And even within those contracts, the cost of labor and the overhead cost should be the same as the FY10 levels. And again, if you presume that a company in that situation has total control over all those costs and what they charge the government, you know, you can argue whether that's a good policy or not. But I think that the issue that you get into is, number one, again, you're putting special terms and conditions on a company selling those services to the federal government, and at the same time, you're basically holding them to things that they don't have total control over.
Right.
Either things that might be mandated in law, or there are things that, for example, health care, insurance costs, things like that, which are not, they don't, you know, the companies can negotiate, but they really don't set the rates, and they're going to be subject to the cost increases.
Right. It's analogous to, like, if you're a product manufacturer or office supply company,
right.
and your costs go up
right.
for raw materials, right?
Right.
I mean, you can't control that, you know.
Right.
China buys a bunch more, you know, of something, that the wholesale price goes up, right?
Right. And so you don't see a lot of that reflected in the legislation, at least that understanding. And now there's a provision in this year's bill that would extend that into fiscal year 14. And so we're looking at that carefully and engaging in discussions and seeing what You know, what would be an appropriate way to deal with that?
You know, I just had a crazy thought. Is that's sort of almost like a different version of low price, technically acceptable approach? I mean, it's really, because it seems to me what it drives in the services arena, that's going to drive people to provide, not their best people.
Right.
Because their best people cost more.
That's right. I mean, it forces those kinds of trade-offs. And of course, for a company, you sort of, I would imagine, work those things to the maximum extent you can. And then the issue is, how much of the margin are you going to lose, to cover the things that you don't have any control over? And especially if you're using FY10 as a baseline, now we're extending that from FY12 to FY13, and then we would be going into FY14. We're getting more and more distance between the fiscal year that we're applying this and the baseline.
Right.
And you look at inflation and other kinds of costs.
That starts to really get a crunch there,
right?
Yeah, right. Absolutely.
It starts really to be an issue.
Yeah. Other provisions?
I would say that those are some of the main ones. There's a provision dealing with the capping contractor employee reimbursement costs. That's another one that we're having a lot of discussion about. Again, what relationship do you want the private sector that is focused on the government as a customer, either partially or fully? And the relationship between that part of the private sector and the rest of the private sector as far as their ability to attract and retain people where there is a limited pool of talent out there, and what would be the impact of that over time. I think that raises those kinds of issues, and we're looking at that right now. So that's one of the major ones. And I think the other ones, the House bill contains a number of provisions in Title 16 dealing with small businesses and trying to increase the
Why don't we take a break, and then when we come back, we'll talk a little bit about what those small business provisions are, and then maybe start to turn to that S word, sequestration, and see what your thoughts are in that area. So we'll be right back. This is Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Join the Coalition for Government Procurement on October 24th and 25th for a two-day training conference, Continuing the Dialogue, at the Crystal Gateway Marriott in Arlington, Virginia. The training will focus on understanding acquisition policy and the federal market, hear how sequestration, declining budgets, and strategic sourcing may affect what the government buys and how they buy it. Any government and industry professional from across the procurement community should attend this event. Register now at the Coalition for Government Procurement's website, www.thecgp.org.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today we are talking to John Etherton of Etherton & Associates, and we've been talking about DOD authorization bill. And, John, when we took the break, you started to talk a little bit about the small business provisions. I'll just give you a couple minutes maybe to outline what they are and what the big ones are, and then we'll move on.
There are a number of provisions in the House bill. If you look at Title 16, in fact, if you add up all of the acquisition policy-related provisions in the House bill, I would say that the small business provisions are over half of what the content is this year, which is interesting. Because in my experience working on the Senate side, the Armed Services Committees on the Senate side, our focus always was trying to support the Department of Defense and its worldwide missions. And we did get suggestions from the small business committees and the Small Business Administration, but I always perceived, at least when I was up there, there was a fair amount of tension between the Armed Services Committee and small business over which view of life would really prevail. And we always would work together and have good conversations, but sometimes there was some disagreements. And I was a little bit surprised the degree to which the House Armed Services Committee adopted, to a great extent, several of the bills that were reported out by the House Small Business Committee as part of their package. A couple of them, I think, will have a fairly major impact on the department if they do get adopted. One of them has to do with creating sort of what they call advanced small businesses, and there are actually a couple of provisions in Title 16 which address this problem. And it's one that I think a lot of folks in the procurement world are familiar with, and that is that you have small businesses who are very successful and thrive in an environment where they can compete for small business set-aside contracts, and as a result of their success, they grow to a certain size, which basically exceeds the small business side standard for their industry code, and now they have to compete in the great big wild world of acquisition, and they just feel like they're overmatched with some of the large companies, which can bring a lot of resources to bear and have other benefits, I guess, that they also have in their favor. and it makes it hard for these newly emerging small businesses to compete. One of the provisions in the bill, Section 1611, would essentially create a new set-aside program for what are called advanced small businesses. And these are really companies that are more in the medium size range that can exceed, I believe, the small business size standards for the industry codes by up to 3 times. And they are then given opportunities to bid as a set-aside program for things that are already determined not to be suitable for a small business set-aside, so they're trying to deconflict the two provisions, but allow those companies to exist in that environment for another 2 or 3 years before graduating if they continue to grow into the larger full and open competition world. It raises a lot of interesting issues. I think for some of the companies, if you look, I suspect that some of the work that would be available in that space is going to be fairly specialized work. Other companies are in that market now that would not qualify as advanced small businesses. So there's been some conflict, I think, on the industry side as people see their addressable market and what is generally considered a shrinking market.
Right. It's a shrinking market, right. And then you're further dividing the market, right? And creating new, it just makes you, stop and think. To me, is it time to look? I understand and supports, the role small business plays in providing opportunity for them. Maybe it's time, get your thoughts. Maybe it's time to think about: are there other, more creative ways to try to help to give them the tools to be really successful beyond? Because really, it is a fundamental challenge that the small businesses are very successful in a set-aside environment because it's a limited market.
Right.
Then they go to the next market and they're equipped to compete in the market for which they're in.
Right.
Then when they try to graduate or they do grow big enough, they're not equipped to compete in that market. And how do you bridge that gap?
Right.
So the question becomes, is another set-aside program the way to address that? Or I don't know what the answer is. I'm just saying.
Yeah, and I don't know the answer either. I think that both Section 1611 approach and the existing set-aside programs are all premised on the idea that the best way that you do that is fostering awards.
Right.
And I don't know if there's another approach post-award or another way of approaching it that doesn't, sort of leverage contract awards as your main tool. I don't really know what the answer to that is. But I think that some people would argue that creating this advanced small business program might create, just another stage, and eventually companies may be in the same position. I don't know if we have the analytic basis to say if you have companies that go through an advanced small business type program, are they better than equipped coming from that environment into the full and open competition environment versus graduating from a small business environment?
I guess someone could say too, then we might need an advanced small business program.
Right, and there's costs in terms of administering it. There's costs in terms of competitive alternatives that you might have if you use a more limited set-aside program. And there are a number of costs that are associated with this, and I don't know, how it'll come out in the conference, but I think it raises a number of interesting issues about how you measure costs versus benefits of taking an approach like that, where your main delivery approach is through contract awards.
Yeah, it is a challenging issue, really, to try to how to address that. You said there are two provisions.
Well, there's another provision in the bill that also, and I think it's Section 1631, if I'm not mistaken, would actually raise the prime and the subcontract goals for agencies. I think the prime goal would go from 23% to 25%. Subcontract goal would go from 37% to 40%. Again, does this have a meaningful impact on what actually happens? Are the programs that the agencies now have currently structured, are they expandable to the point where increasing the goal would have a meaningful impact on actually increasing the amount of awards to small businesses? And I don't know. Some part of me says, well, raise the goal to 100%. I mean, if you don't have the tools in place and you don't have the capacity in place to make it work with the existing goals and the agencies, as I understand it, are falling short most years on the existing goals, what does increasing the goals really accomplish? I think that raises a number of issues, and it may be the appropriate thing to do, but I think the real question is, if you do it, is it realistic? Yeah, what difference is it going to make?
Yeah, because if you don't meet a 23% goal, are you going to meet the 25%, or are you going to get to 23% trying to get to 25?
Right,
I guess that might be part of the theory, right? Yeah. And then they'll still be able to say, but you're not meeting the government-wide goal, right?
Right.
You know, you get to 23%. So, you know, why don't we turn a little bit to another, you know, very timely topic, that's sequestration.
Sure.
And I guess just quickly, can you describe what it is? And if, just for the listeners, I know a lot of folks have heard it, but where are we in it? Maybe that's a better question.
With the Budget Control Act passed last August, not in August 2011, and the whole idea with the mechanism of sequestration, first we were going to have a super committee that was going to meet, a bipartisan House-Senate group, that would try to come up with a plan to cut, I think it was $1.2 billion. They failed. They didn't succeed in doing that. So the mechanism then that is left is sequestration. And it basically, if the budget does not meet the targets under the Budget and Control Act for FY13, then what we have is for FY13 only. This doesn't apply in the later years, but for FY13 only, we have essentially what is effectively taking back of money that was otherwise unobligated appropriated money in FY13. The mechanism, the way it's set up now, is that it will go into effect on January 2nd unless Congress takes some action, which they'll have to do, obviously, in conjunction with the executive branch. And based on the calculations that OMB and CBO have put out, there'll be a sort of a shared burden on discretionary spending of essentially on the each side of about $55 billion. That would come out of the unobligated balances for FY13. In the case of the Department of Defense, prior year unobligated balances are added into the FY13 unobligated balances, and that those would be the pool of monies that sequestration would apply to. On the civilian side, it would only be the FY13 appropriations that would do that. And the department, under the rules for sequestration, the department's money is basically parsed out in about 60 different accounts. And that includes things like procurement Army, procurement Air Force, other procurement Army, other procurement Air Force, things like that, as well as operations and maintenance, military construction, personnel, and research development and evaluation accounts. And so what the mechanism, I guess, that they are going to use to sequester the money will be to go down, and I'm more familiar with this on the Department of Defense side, where I think the definitions are a little bit clearer, to the project, program, or activity within the RDT&E procurement and military construction accounts. The personnel accounts have been exempted. The president had that right to in the law, and he said he will exempt the personnel accounts, so they will not be touched under sequestration. And then for the operations and maintenance accounts, what the Office of Management and Budget has ruled that account, the sequestration will apply at the account level. So in other words, for Army operations and maintenance, there'll be a number rather than down in the individual project or program level. What the department has said as far as the operations and maintenance accounts is they will take every action in their power to shield the overseas contingency operation monies in operations and maintenance, which means that the non-OCO or money will suffer a disproportionate share of the cuts if sequestration goes into effect. The numbers that they're talking about now is 9.4%. That was the report that they provided to the House and Senate last month. I think the number probably goes up just a little bit. It's probably going to be closer to around 10% by the time you factor in different things. And the real question is what really happens on January 2nd if sequestration goes into effect.
Okay, and right there is where January 2nd, what happens then? We'll get some more on that when we come back. You're listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio, 1500 AM.
In the ever-changing national security and IT environments, L3 delivers innovative, cost-effective solutions. As a Fortune 200 company, L3 offers customers global end-to-end services and solutions for large-scale systems. No matter the challenge, L3 has the agility, technology, and innovation required for mission performance. From cybersecurity to next-generation IT, L3's passion for its customers' missions drives its commitment to excellence. L3. Agility, innovation, performance.
Welcome back to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM. Today, my guest is John Etherton of Etherton Associates. And John, when we took that break, you were about to tell the world what was going to happen on January 2nd.
Well,
or at least, you know, give your thoughts on what may or may not happen. I know it's pretty imprecise, I think, right?
It's imprecise, and I think, you know, assuming that nothing is done and sequestration is triggered, it's not clear how quickly OMB and the agencies will act to actually implement the cuts and how those will all be done. Obviously, you've got, for example, in the procurement and RDT&E world, and in particular, you've got contract issues and contract clauses. Sequestration does not set aside the legal requirements that the federal government has under contracts. I mean, there are flexibilities there that could be utilized if there's some money that has to be slowed or taken or whatever, but the contracts are still going to be in place and they'll still be intact. And again, I don't know what the plans will be. I think one of the things that we've seen in the initial or the most recent report, rather, that we got from OMB was that the department is going to go down into the individual line items in these budgets, and it's about 2,500 programs and projects. And they've just basically established this 9.4% reduction. In some cases, you may have several contracts that you have, or you may have unobligated funds that you may be able to use for that. Other places, you may not have that flexibility. Some people have suggested that one of the things that the department may want to prepare immediately in the event that they do have to go into sequestration at some point is a reprogramming request, which would go to Congress. But there are limitations on how much you can do with that. Because a reprogramming request, there is a general transfer authority every year that the department gets of $5 billion, which they can transfer money up to that amount between accounts. They can do inside account transfers, and there's no cap on that. But a reprogramming request, if it's above a certain threshold in these various accounts, has to go to the Congress and has to be approved separately by four committees, each of whom can veto any piece of it, both the source of funds and the destination of funds. So that's really not a very viable mechanism.
Well, and also, if it's $55 billion, right, it's $5 billion, you know.
Well, but that's, again, in between accounts. So you would have the flexibility within an account if you had to take things at the project, program, or activity level to move money within the account and get approval for that without impacting the overall general transfer authority amount. So you could do that. But again, if you look at the numbers and the percentages and things, it really doesn't give you very much flexibility. In fact, if that mechanism really starts to work. Beyond that, it's hard to say. I don't know how quickly the mechanisms would be put in place. It would be not clear exactly what programs would be affected, how the priorities would be reflected, and the department has been very careful to say that they don't have any real plans that they can share right now as to how they would do that. So I don't know. Some people have suggested that we have the pending expiration of the Bush tax cuts, that there is the revenues that would generate could offset the numbers that they need for sequestration, assuming that you get a political consensus around the idea of increasing taxes, which I'm not even going to go down that road to see if that would happen. Even if you were able to be successful in a way to come up with an amount of money that could be used to offset sequestration, or the amount that would take to avoid sequestration, Congress would still have to pass a law to tie those two things together. It would not happen automatically. There's no mechanism within the Budget Control Act to allow for that. So when you factor that in with these other issues that are coming up, the so-called fiscal cliff issues, as we get close to the end of the year, it's going to be quite a no matter what happens in the election, it's going to be a real challenge.
Right. And do you see, I guess, I don't know if this is a fair question or not, or this is crystal ball time, do you see the lame duck addressing these things, or do you see it being put off to the new Congress?
I could see, frankly, that
it could go either way?
It could go either way. I really don't have a clear sense. Even if you were presuming a certain outcome at the, you know, in the elections for the House, Senate, or the White House, it's very, very difficult to sort of lay out, given where the votes have been over the past year on various other fiscal issues, it's very difficult to see, you know, how you know, what a plan might look like, or whether a plan would even be possible to address some of those things. I just don't have a real good sense of it at this point.
Yeah. Well, you know, the whole sequestration, you know, and the budget and thinking about the Department of Defense, I thought I would ask you this question that, you know, when, you know, the country has a vision, or the leadership has a vision of what, you know, our national security, you know, obligations, responsibilities should be, what the mission, and then the question is, do you have the resources and the tools to meet the mission that's been defined by the leadership? And I thought it might be interesting just to ask you, like, you know, because you worked on the Hill for you know, a long time, like 18 years,
18
I think.
18 years, right.
And spent a lot of time in the Senate Armed Services Committee. How does that dynamic work when between the legislative branch and the executive branch? It seems to me, someone who, you know, by confession, didn't work in the DOD world, but just right. It seems to different sort of, or maybe not so different in terms of thinking about the mission and what's necessary to meet the mission and how that is all worked out between the legislature. I mean, maybe I'm not making sense.
No, but I understand what you're saying, and I guess this is what I would say about it. I think that there has been a real interest in the Congress through mechanisms like the Goldwater-Nichols bill and some of the other requirements, and this was primarily my world, former world in the Armed Services Committees, to actually, you know, try to structure the decision-making in the department to set, you know, have an impact on the organization, the kinds of ways the department needs to look at the world. And then, you know, do oversight over that process. And then I think when the budgets actually come over for a given fiscal year, to try to match that up with this emerging vision that Congress has helped shape through some of these mechanisms, passing laws and setting up offices and setting up requirements and reporting and things like that, to see how well they match up. It's been my experience that if the department, you know, came over with a budget request, that there was a lot of discussion around the margins of moving money and things like that, but generally the department, the major thrust of what the department through that process put forward, Congress was generally willing to approve. And it was more, and again, looking at it from the armed services perspective, it was more shaping the organization, you know, the way that the issues were thought of before the budget was actually put together, I think was where the committees tended to have a lot of influence. So I would expect to see a lot of discussion in the coming 2 or 3 years, especially as we withdraw from Afghanistan, as we look at the next stage, you know, what does the department come forward with as a new mission? How did they put it together? What did they, and then sort of matching that up against the actual request. And I think that's how the committee's likely to play the greatest role. I don't see, for example, the department sending over a budget and Congress massively restructuring it to support a different vision, say, than the Department of Defense is operating under. I think it's more of a matter of how well are you supporting the mission that you've laid out based on the criteria that we put together with you as to how you would form your thinking and what sort of strategic process you would follow.
It's sort of like putting a framework in place through which people can make the decision making.
Right. Having oversight over what the actual
sort of makes are. You know, to ensure it makes sense,
right.
From the big picture.
But I think the department has a great deal of flexibility in the details.
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's interesting. You know, just also big picture, just on another topic, and, you know, this is a surprise question. You mentioned earlier about the idea of these additional requirements on commercial item contracting.
Right.
Do you have a sense where, you know, and it's almost to me, it's like chipping away at the idea of commercial item contracting and having access to that market in government? Because of the nature of government unique requirements, it further limits competition. Do you see that trend growing over the next few years due to budget? People thinking that's the way to ensure, you know, we get cost savings out of procurement? Or do you see a potential for people to say, hey, you know, maybe we need to go back and reinvigorate commercial item contracting?
I think there's always been a tension between the commercial item and the commercial marketplace and the Department of Defense. Because the department's timelines, the way they use technology, the way they integrate it, and how long they keep it versus the commercial marketplace, the demands that the Department of Defense has for, you know, ruggedness and robustness and things like that, and the way they do their technology deployment, there's always been this tension. And I think that at a time when the department had a lot of money, and there were certain major sectors of the marketplace that they could dominate with that, you tended to have more government unique kinds of products because we could afford a system, and the system tended to be built around the department's and the government's basically acquisition cycles. To the extent that you move more in a commercial marketplace, you have to adapt to this idea that you're going to buy something, use it for a relatively short period of time, and then get rid of it for the next generation of whatever, or be stuck with something that has a degrading ability by industry to support it. And I think that's been an issue ever since there's been this pressure. If you look at the underlying statutes and the overall policy guidance that exists now in Title X, there is still a preference for the use of commercial items and commercial technologies, and that hasn't changed. And I think if you talk to the Armed Services Committee folks on either the House or Senate side, they would say that they fully support that. I think the real argument is, as we make these changes and we strive for greater process integrity, you know, what impact do the, you know, how does that affect the balance? And we have disagreements about that. Some folks think that some of these changes are very targeted. They will have very limited impact. Other folks are concerned because they think the impact will be much, much broader. And I think as this discussion this year and whatever follow-on legislation people bring up will help clarify that a great deal. But I do think we're getting to a point now where we need to make some broader decisions about what terms and conditions do we want to set on companies who do business with the federal government that are different than anything else they face in other markets, and how much of that, you know, do we want to impose, and what the impact will that be on the supply chain supplying the government.
Right, right. Well, on that note, John, I want to thank you for being on the show today. Very illuminating discussion. It always is when you come on. I just really love it. It's good stuff. And so thank you, John Etherton of Etherton & Associates, and you've been listening to Off the Shelf on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
You've been listening to Off the Shelf with Roger Waldron of the Coalition for Government Procurement. If you missed any part of this program, you can hear the entire show on our website, federalnewsradio.com. Off the Shelf, Tuesday mornings at 10:30, only on Federal News Radio 1500 AM.
Join the Coalition for Government Procurement on October 24th and 25th for a two-day training conference, Continuing the Dialogue, at the Crystal Gateway Marriott in Arlington, Virginia. The training will focus on understanding acquisition policy and the federal market. Hear how sequestration, declining budgets, and strategic sourcing may affect what the government buys and how they buy it. Any government and industry professional from across the procurement community should attend this event. Register now at the Coalition for Government Procurement's website, www.thecgp.org.